Luc Besson is probably best known for directing La Femme Nikita in 1990. But in the last two decades, he has also presided over the hugely successful production company EuropaCorp, which makes such action hits as The Transporter, District 13, and Taken. EuropaCorp's latest film is From Paris with Love, and stars John Travolta as a freewheeling American operative and Jonathan Rhys-Meyers as his reluctant sidekick. Film critic David Edelstein has this review.
After the 2003 invasion of Iraq, France became the most outspoken European critic of American exceptionalism, the idea that the U.S., with its cowboy diplomacy, can act unilaterally without regard for international law. So it's quite a surprise that one of France's most successful filmmakers, Luc Besson, has made a new career producing and co-writing Paris-set action movies that celebrate take-no-prisoners American machismo. Last year's Taken, directed by Besson's former cinematographer Pierre Morel, stars Liam Neeson as an ex-CIA spook whose teenage daughter gets snatched in Paris by Albanian sex slavers. Since the French are all apathetic or corrupt, it falls to Neeson to beat up, torture, and take out wave after wave of Albanians and Arabs and other scummy thugs. The fantasy might be primitive, but Taken is the filet mignon of meathead vigilante movies, with Neeson stripped down to pure, righteous, patriarchal American genius. Now Besson and director Morel are back with an even bigger and badder American macho fantasy called From Paris with Love, starring John Travolta with a bald dome and a wispy goatee as Charlie Wax, a gonzo, but as it turns out, unbelievably proficient terrorist hunter. Like Neeson in Taken, Travolta's Wax has no patience with prissy bureaucrats or diplomatic niceties, so Besson and Morel pair him with a prissy diplomat named James Reese, played by Jonathan Rhys-Meyers. There's nearly an international incident when Wax arrives at the airport and browbeats a French customs agent into letting him bring energy drinks into the country, cans that, as he later reveals to Reese in their car, carry hidden contents with more kick than caffeine.
You know that really wasn't necessary back there?
Yeah, I know. I just like sticking to these self-righteous little books. Think just because they got a badge and a uniform, they can lord over us civilians anytime the mood strikes them.
And you know we can probably get that drink in any supermarket?
Yeah, I know that too.
So what's the big deal over some corn syrup, caffeine, and water?
Well, the big deal is my secret ingredient, which I could not take the chance that they would find out about.
You mean everything back there was...
You didn't get that?
You know I'm authorized to get you any weapon you want.
Yeah, but not like this one. Because me and Mrs. Jones, we got a thing going on. Till death do us part.
Travolta is a wonder. Sure, he's beefy. He isn't the first actor to spring to mind in connection with lightning reflexes. But he's souped up and limber and elated by his own Zen prowess. And the choreography and editing of his fight scenes are so expert that I never detected the substitution of stuntmen. Like Taken, From Paris with Love moves at warp speed. It's barely 90 minutes, a nice change from most bloated modern action pictures. And there isn't a wasted shot. In scene after scene, hordes of terrorists become blood-spurting pinwheels that hit the ground the instant you manage to breathe out. Your exhalations become gasps of amazement. Morel will inevitably be compared to director John Woo, but I think he's better. He has fewer mannerisms than Woo and a keener eye. His fastest, most kinetic shots flow together like frames in a flipbook. But Morel's drollest scene in From Paris with Love represents the art of holding back. Travolta bursts through a door at the top of a circular staircase while Rhys-Meyers waits below, and the camera stays with him as one body after another sails or bounces or crunches past. Travolta's Wax teaches Rhys that diplomacy is fine, but there's no substitute for training, knowledge, and guts, for sheer mastery. It can be argued that From Paris with Love is simple-minded and formulaic, and that Besson and Morel are pandering to an American audience that can't win the war on terror in reality, and so clings to juvenile fantasies. I might have argued that, too, if the film hadn't fired me up the way it did. Maybe because they're French, Besson and Morel can celebrate the archetype of the gonzo American warrior without guilt or the kind of grim psychological frame of Catherine Bigelow's great The Hurt Locker. They make you remember how spectacularly cool it was before reality got in the way.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel. Snowpocalypse, Snowmageddon, Super Snowbowl. Just some of the words used to describe a winter storm that is upon us here in Washington. The National Weather Service is forecasting 1 to 2 feet of snow for the Mid-Atlantic region. The threat of a monster storm was enough to close schools, offices, even the courts here. Airlines have canceled flights in and out of the region. Grocery stores have been mobbed as people hunker down for the storm, and perhaps for the Super Bowl, too. The flurry of activity has us wondering, what are the economics of a snowstorm? And it turns out there is such a thing as a weather economist, and we're joined by one now, Scott Bernhardt. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Robert.
And let's start with this run on the stores. We've had word that shelves at some of the local supermarkets are empty. Ski shops in the area have sold out of their cross-country skis. Can a storm provide a kind of a stimulus to a region?
Well, it'll be a pocketed stimulus, if you will. There's certainly a flurry of activity right before a storm, and certainly for snow-related products. Certainly snow throwers, shovels, rock salt, things of that nature are moving off the shelves, as are bread, eggs, bottled water. I'm not quite sure why that one is, but bottled water sells very well. Milk, things of that nature, yes. But that said, it's still pretty much a net negative to a region to have a storm of this magnitude.
I think the bottled water goes because south of New England, a snowstorm brings out the survivalist in lots of people.
I suppose that's true, yes.
And what sort of costs are local governments facing during this snowstorm? We know about salting the roads, for example.
Yes, significant ones. And again, it depends on the region and how hard, but there are significant costs to areas, you know, such as Washington, D.C., Baltimore. They're just not snow cities historically, and they really just don't budget quite enough for this type of storm. I mean, if we look at it back right before Christmas, we had a significant storm in this region as well that probably gobbled up an awful lot of their snow removal budget. And now, unusually, we have yet another monster storm coming into the region that is sure to have a negative impact.
We've heard about a lot of canceled flights. People aren't getting out or getting in. How big a hit are the airlines taking?
A significant one. Again, they, you know, due to the region and the sheer volume of people who live in and travel out of the part of the country that's going to be affected by this storm, it has a significant impact. The airlines have been very aggressive and I think very smart in moving people to different connection cities and moving in advance of the storm rather than having people show up at the airport and sleep in the terminals. They're reaching out to people and I think have done a great job of it, but they're not going to get to everyone and there's going to be people still sleeping at the terminal, I'm afraid.
I did see a graph on a NOAA website which suggested there are some benefits of a snowstorm. Those are for tourism and ski areas and also for cold water fishing. The water is good for that, I gather, and also just the water supply.
That's correct, but you know, it's just going to be more Washington, D.C. than it is Minnesota. So it's still going to, you know, be a net negative. I suppose that one of the main positives from the snow happening this weekend is that it's not going to be next weekend, meaning that we're not going to have a snowed out situation for President's Day weekend and all of the economic activity of that, nor is it going to have too much snow for people to celebrate Valentine's Day, which by itself is estimated to be around $14 billion in spend. So, you know, if there can be a silver lining on this particular weekend storm as you're out there shoveling, just be thankful it's not next weekend.
Is there any lore among weather economists of a snowstorm that had a particularly salient economic impact?
Probably there was a major storm in 1996, January of 96, that came up through the Washington, D.C., Philadelphia, New York, all the way into New England and Boston region. That is, that was just a whopper.
Has anyone ventured a dollar cost of that snowstorm?
No, I'm afraid not. I'm afraid not.
I think that's
we estimated the Super Saturday storm, the one that was right before Christmas, at being well over $2 billion. Right, that was significant as well.
Just in 2009, you're saying?
That was in 2009, yes.
Scott Bernhardt, Chief Operating Officer of Planalytics, a company that studies the economic impact of the weather. Thanks a lot for talking with us.
Thank you, Robert.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel. The New Orleans Saints play the Indianapolis Colts in Super Bowl 44, spelt XLIV, on Sunday. It's easy to lose sight of the game itself, but with all the hoopla during the two-week build-up to the main event. So helping us to regain our focus and talk about the actual game, NPR's Mike Pesco is in Miami. Hi, Mike.
Hello.
I know we in the media have been distracted from the game itself by stories about the shirts they sell in New Orleans and Colts quarterback Peyton Manning's skills as a commercial pitchman. Do the players, do you think, get distracted by all of this down there?
It's a little hard not to, and it's preached into them that we must remain focused, and they say they're going to remain focused. But, of course, history has a number of examples where players have gone off the rails. There was the Bengal, Stanley Wilson, who was cut from the team. He was on drugs the day before the Super Bowl. A Raider, Barrett Robbins, he had psychological problems. He just disappeared. And a Falcon, Eugene Robinson, was arrested for soliciting a prostitute before his game. I think he was also awarded a Man of the Year award that week. And all those teams lost. So it happens. But if you look at the teams in the game today, the Colts, it would be very rare. They've been here three years ago, and they seem to be a very focused team. They seem to shrug off controversy. Now, the Saints are a little bit of a looser group, and they all know to say that the game is the important thing. But at 3 a.m. on Monday, or maybe this was into Tuesday morning, some Saints were spotted out on the town, and this became a little bit of a controversy. To my mind, it's absolutely much ado about nothing. It's 6 days before the game, and there are a bunch of 20-something guys out in a bar. Who cares? But that's the sort of thing. In the absence of real news, it's the sort of thing that the 3,000 members of the media have to pick over.
Now, shrugging off controversy is one thing. Shrugging off injury is another. And there is certainly one meaningful injury here, and that's to the Colts defensive end, Dwight Freeney. How's he doing?
Dwight Freeney has a grade 3 sprain on his ankle. It means a ligament tear. And it's funny, you hear all the supposed experts saying how Dwight Freeney's tough and he could tough it out. It's not about toughness. It's about a tear to your ligament in the ankle. And that could seriously limit the number of plays he plays and when he's on the field, if he could really do anything. And if the Colts don't have Dwight Freeney, who was named to the All-Decade team, he's a fantastic player, it does a couple things. It means that the Saints don't have to double-team him, so they could send an extra receiver out. It means the Saints can now double-team his line mates, who often thrive just due to the fact that Dwight Freeney draws so much attention. So it really is a big injury. But oddly enough, the people who are predicting who's going to win seem not to have factored it in at all. I don't see anyone saying, I thought the Colts would win, but now with Freeney's injury, I don't. So I don't know if Freeney's going to shrug it off, but it seems like all these so-called experts have shrugged it off.
Yeah, the Colts are still favored. And of course, when we talk about Freeney, we're talking about what he could do to the Saints' passing game. They have a passing game, too. This could be a pretty high-scoring Super Bowl, given the amount of passing we'd
expect. It is indeed predicted to be the highest-scoring Super Bowl ever by the people who decide such things in Las Vegas, and that seems like a pretty reasonable assumption. The New Orleans Saints have a great head coach, Sean Payton, and a great quarterback, and they put a lot of guys out there. They don't have one dominant receiver, but they can, here's a football term, spread the ball around. And the Colts are just, I mean, Peyton Manning is just such a fantastic quarterback. We're not going to hear a lot. I don't think we're going to hear a lot about the running game. The Colts actually had the worst rushing game in the league last year, but it should be noted that the Saints were one of the worst rush defenses. So it's kind of the inverse of the immovable object and the unstoppable force. It's the, you know, marshmallow object and the kind of weak force, but which is more marshmallowy and which is more weak? Maybe the Colts can have a little bit of a run game, but I expect most of the points to be scored through the air.
NPR's Mike Pesca in Miami for the Super Bowl. Thanks for talking to us. Have fun.
You're welcome.
Astronauts often say that one of the best things about being in space is looking down at the beautiful blue Earth. Well, now the International Space Station is about to get what NASA is calling a room with a view. It's a kind of observation tower that will give astronauts a window on the world unlike any other in space. NPR's Nell Greenfield Boyce reports.
Right now, astronauts on board the station can peer out through small portholes. The biggest, best window is in the U.S. Destiny Lab. It's a porthole 20 inches across. But this Sunday morning, Space Shuttle Endeavour is scheduled to blast off on a mission to deliver a new room to the station. This room will have a 360-degree bay window called the cupola. It has 7 windows, so astronauts can float inside and be surrounded by panoramic views. Terry Virts will be a first-time space flyer on the Endeavour mission.
The one thing that I'm really looking forward to, and I know all my crewmates are also, is getting a chance to look out of the cupola with the 7 windows and the view that we're going to get there. That's going to be really special to see that view of the Earth and of space, and that's going to be fun.
Technically, the new windows aren't for fun. They'll help astronauts orchestrate outside work, things like spacewalks, robotic arm operations, and docking spaceships. And the windows do have aluminum shutters that will often be closed. That's to keep them from being hit by tiny bits of flying space rock or space junk, even though the tough windows already are several panes thick. Still, the astronauts can't wait to get the new room all installed and finally open those shutters for the first time. Kay Heyer is an astronaut going up on Endeavour.
We will definitely be bringing along some still cameras as well as video cameras to try to capture those views as best we can to share with you.
But she says she can guarantee those photos won't be able to convey exactly what it's like to see the vast expanse of Earth and space spread out all around. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.